leafing or vegetable gardening. You might want to do it every 5 to 10 years just to reestablish those baselines, because soil does change, you know, as you work it and as you use it. Okay, so again, I'm going through these 7 principles. So now we're to irrigation. Where you all live, just by show of hands, do you have irrigation clocks on your line, on your turf or your perennial beds or whatever? Yeah. So you really, this surprises people, but you really need to check those controls at least once a month. What happens a lot is people will set it and they think, okay, I'm good to go for the year, and they walk away. But heads get clogged. You know, we get more precipitation or less precipitation. And if you can check them once a month, you're going to water more efficiently and you're going to use less water. So you kind of need to have an intimate knowledge of what's going on with your irrigation if you're really serious about water conservation. You can have big gains or losses if you have a head that pops up to water a perennial bed or turf that's tilted a little bit. Maybe it got knocked when it was being, you know, the lawnmower went over or something. If it's tilted like this, it's gonna, the water spray is gonna go in a completely different pattern. You're gonna lose a lot of water from drift. The wind is gonna actually take a considerable amount of water away. Also, if it's tilted this way, it's gonna shoot straight down and it's not gonna get, you know, where you want it to be. So really looking at your irrigation controls and heads is pretty important. Of course, you only want to water when necessary. That's why you don't want to just set it and forget it. If you have the option of doing different kinds of irrigation, that is important. There's drip irrigation, there's overhead sprinkler sprays, then there's hand if you're just going out with a hose or a watering can. All of those have different levels of efficiency. So hand watering is the most efficient because you know you're just applying what's needed when it's needed. Drip is the next most efficient because it's just putting it right down at the soil level. It's not spraying, which is where you lose some of that water. And then overhead. So we have lots of fact sheets on irrigation on our website. That's what the handouts are that I brought, are fact sheets. So if you have more questions about that, you can do that. So next for irrigation is a concept called hydrozones. This is basically just a style of landscaping or how you plant your plants. And it's irrigation done by area rather than by plant. So you group plants with similar water needs together. So if you have this bunch of plants and they all have low water needs, you want to put them together. And then if you have plants with high water needs, you want to put those together rather than mixing and matching. So you want to have a combination of these look really nice together and they have the same water needs. Because if you have a high water use plant right next to a low water use plant, one of them or both of them are not going to get what they need because they're on the same irrigation zone, basically. So that's hydrozoning. We recommend putting, if you have the opportunity, we recommend putting your higher water use plants closer to your house because you're going to see them more frequently and you're going to notice if they need more water. And then you sort of go out from their less water use as you get further away. And I want to point out, this is not to say that you can't have high water use plants. You might have a favorite plant that, yeah, it uses a lot of water, but it brings you so much joy. Well, then by all means, have that plant. But just know how much water it needs and be really mindful about where you place it. That'll help with the water conservation. So next is mulch. I said mulch is a really important tool for water conservation. So if you have a nice thick layer of organic mulch, and by organic I mean like wood chip or bark mulch, you can reduce irrigation needs by as much as 50%. That's a ton. As mulch breaks down, it improves the soil, it builds the soil, it protects the plants and the root zones. It inhibits weeds, it does not stop weeds from growing. People always hope it will, but they're weeds, so they will grow. So mulch is really, really important. We don't recommend plastic or landscape fabric. That used to be common practice. Horticulture agents that were standing up here 10, 15 years ago were saying, use plastic and landscape fabric. Well, we've changed our tune. They really don't do much. weeds will still grow on top. They often won't allow water to penetrate through, and they don't allow gas exchange. So there's a lot of important oxygen and gas exchange that happens at the soil level, and if you smother it with plastic, that can't happen. So it was meant to be sort of a, oh, this will be really convenient, and it'll help suppress weeds and all this different stuff, but it doesn't work as well as the industry hoped.
So if we have that, we should take it out.
Well, if you have that and you can take it out, you should. If you have a ton of it, I wouldn't say you absolutely have to, but if you were going to redo an area anyway, take it out and leave it out. Yep. And also, it's always sort of, you know, coming up at the edges, and you're always trying to tuck it down in, and it's really kind of more of a pain than it's worth. So different kinds of mulch. We've got organic, as I said, like wood chip. You can also use pine needles and straw and grass clippings. That's not really common practice, but those are considered organic mulches. Really, we're looking at the bark mulch and the wood chip mulch. That's what's more common. And then we have inorganic mulches, gravels. So those you're going to use in a really dry bed or like a rock garden where you don't want moisture to be held around the crown or the base of the plant. Because some plants don't want to be wet right there. And so if you have a nice thick layer of organic mulch, it's going to hold moisture and rot the plant out. So if you have very, very xeric plants, gravel mulch is probably going to be your best bet. So when to apply mulch, you can really do it any time of year. It's not a seasonal thing. It's not like you only do it in the spring or only in the fall. If your beds need mulch, put the mulch down. Again, if it's organic, you want a nice thick 3 to 4 inch layer. It will break down. Some of it will blow away. That's just sort of the nature of it, but you can reapply it. If you're using the inorganic mulch, you really only need like a layering, a covering. So an inch, maybe 2 inches, depending on your situation. This is super important. We don't want to see mulch volcanoes. We often see this around the base of trees. People think, oh, I'm doing the right thing. I'm protecting my tree and I'm helping it out, but that actually really hurts the trees. So if you can see this graphic here, that is a mulch volcano. It goes all the way up around the trunk and the base of the tree. That will actually kill your tree over time. Trees take a long time to let us know that something is wrong. But if you have that for many seasons, what starts to happen is the trunk and the bark can start to rot because there's all that moisture held right around it. And right at the base of a tree, I don't know if there are any trees right out here that I can, nope, there's a shed. I thought maybe there'd be a tree I could just point to out the window. If you look at the base of a tree, there's a flare. It flares out at the base. And at that flare, there's lots of gas and oxygen exchange. And so if you cover that, again, if you smother that with mulch, that can't be happening, and it kind of suffocates the tree. So to that end, if you see a tree that looks like a telephone pole and there's no flare, then it's probably planted too deeply, and it won't last long. So you want your mulch around trees to go out as far as you can to the drip line, to the end of the canopy, and you really want to leave a space right around the trunk. So what you're not trying to protect the trunk, you're trying to protect the root zone of the tree. Have I harped on this enough? We really don't want to see mulch volcanoes. I get called out so much. People are like, I don't know, am I trying to do all the right things? What's wrong with my tree? And it's as simple as we just need to pull the mulch away.
You won't find any on that property.
Okay.
Now, inorganic, that means rocks?
Inorganic is rocks.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so we've gone through planning for conservation, soil, irrigation, mulch. I might have missed one. But now we're on to turf. So assessing our turf areas. There's a lot about, you know, some people think, well, turf is bad. Kentucky bluegrass is bad. We need to get rid of it all. I disagree with that. I think there's a time and a place for turf. If it's being used, if if the situation calls for turf, then by all means have turf. Just manage it correctly. But if you have an area where you don't need turf, you're not really using it, it's too shady, and so it's getting really thin, then I think let's reassess and maybe take this turf out and do something else. But if kids are playing on it or you have pets that like it or whatever, then by all means you can still have it and maintain it. You just want to manage it well so that it's not using too much water. I like this little comic I came across a few years ago. Dad is out there mowing the lawn. It's what I do on Saturday mornings, you know. And the kid says, "Dad, I think we need to have a talk about the bees and the flowers," implying perhaps we don't need this turf. Some people love to get out on the weekends and mow their lawn. And if that brings you pleasure, then by all means stick with it. But if really your turf is just there to be mowed and fertilized and watered and you're not using it for much more, maybe think about getting rid of it. So how do we remove turf? Yeah.
More and more of the people in my neighborhood are starting to put AstroTurf in their yard.
Okay. She says more and more people in her neighborhood are starting to put AstroTurf down. And are you wondering what I think about that? I'm not a fan. So that is sort of a trend. People think, well, it still looks green. It has the nice aesthetic look. And I don't have to water it.
It gets dirty.
So A, it gets dirty. B, it gets really hot. It gets so hot you can't walk on it in the heat of the summer. It breaks down. It's plastic that you're putting down on the ground. It kills the soil underneath if you ever do want to plant anything, because again, it's like a thick sheet of plastic that, you know, you're not allowing oxygen and gas exchange. So again, pretty much every landscape question I can say it depends, which is a nice out for me. So it does depend on the situation, but yeah, avoiding AstroTurf is really much better. It's much better to have, if you don't want turf, that's fine. Have a nice mulched bed with a few landscape rocks and like a shrub. You know, have minimal landscaping if you don't want to do the maintenance. But yeah, putting AstroTurf everywhere is not really the answer to water conservation. And it actually requires maintenance. People don't realize that, but it really does. Yes?
I had a question about letting a turf area go dormant for a season or two.
Yeah.
What's your take on that?
Okay, so she's asking about letting a turf area go dormant for a season or two. Most often, you can definitely do that. So bluegrass, what most of our lawns here are cool season grasses. We have cool season and warm season grasses. And so that basically means they're living at certain times when the dependent on the temperature. So what Kentucky bluegrass wants to do is when it gets really hot in the summer, it wants to shut down. It wants to go dormant. And so if we left it to its own devices, it would be green in the cool months. It would kind of shut down and get brown, you know, July through September, and then it would green up again October and November until it gets too cold. But we want it to be really green, so we dump water on it because we think, oh, it's turning brown, it's dying. It's not actually dying. Most often, sometimes there are situations where it's dying, but usually it's just going dormant. So you can definitely do that. You don't have to dump water on it all summer unless you want it to be brown.
So can you still walk on it? I mean, how vulnerable is it to traffic?
It is a little less vulnerable because if it gets too dry, the blades will start to crack off. But really, all the life is down at the, like, if this is your grass plant, these are the blades. All the life is here at the crown and down in the roots. So the blades are brown, and you can still walk on those. If it had really heavy traffic, you would start to damage the crown, and then it would have a hard time putting the leaf blades back up. But yeah, you can definitely let it go dormant. If it's a really hot, really dry summer, you might want to water it periodically because letting it go too long, it will die without water. But you don't have to water it continually. And again, the only reason we have emerald green lawns is the summer is because we're essentially overwatering it so that we have it green. So if you do want to remove turf, you can see I say stop watering, but that often takes more than one season. It often won't die after one season. You can smother it with newspapers. Really, you get a nice thick layer of newspaper and put rocks or boards or something down so that not a lot of air gets underneath there. And slowly but surely, that will kill it because it's not getting sunlight, so it can't create its energy through photosynthesis. And then, of course, you can use herbicide. That's sort of a quick and easy way to do it. So then once you have your area, your dead area of grass, You can actually leave it in place, and often you can sort of just plant in and among it, and it'll sort of work as a mulch. It will, you know, it holds the soil, and it'll just sort of break down eventually. The risk in that is if you think it's dead, but it's not totally dead. So then you plant other things in there, and you start watering those in, and the turf says, oh, I wasn't quite dead yet, I'm going to start growing again. So you have to be careful with that. But you can also till it under and leave that dead organic matter in the soil. That's going to build your soil. We don't recommend using plastic. You can solarize. It's called solarizing with plastic, where you basically smother it like you do with the newspapers. You just don't want to leave the plastic on too long, because then you start to mess with the soil, the life in the soil. And you don't want to do gravel. Sometimes people think, I'm just going to dump a bunch of gravel on there, but turf is tough, and it'll find its way and start growing through the gravel. So stop watering, smother.
The newspapers, do you just leave them there forever, or do you take them off eventually?
You can sort of do both. It takes quite a bit of time, and you want to, they might start to break down, and then you can leave it, and that'll break in, or build the soil again. But it sort of depends on your timeline. If the grass is dead and you're ready to move on, then you can take that up and compost it or something. So it's either, depending on your situation. So lawn alternatives. You can convert your lawn to a different species of grass that is less water intensive, like blue grama or buffalo grass. Those are two native grasses to Colorado. Has a very different aesthetic. It's a pale, they're sort of a pale green. It's not going to be that rich, dark emerald green. Buffalo grass is a warm season grass. So it's only going to be green during the hot months, and then the rest of the time it's going to be brown. So it's sort of the opposite of Kentucky bluegrass. So you just have to manage that. The other option is to just have less turf, right? Maybe you still want some turf, but your whole yard isn't turf. So there are all different things you can do to kind of manage and reduce the turf footprint. So next we look to plant selection. So there was a study done in 2002, which I'm now realizing is a very long time ago. We should do a new study. But it was done in Colorado Springs. They've done a lot of water use and landscape studies, and it compared water use between traditional landscapes and xeric landscapes, and the water savings ranged from 15 to 63%. So that's a really large range, but if I saved just 15% of water on my landscape, I'd be really happy. If I was saving 63%, that's huge. So clearly, xeric landscapes save water. So native plants often top the list for xeric plants because they're used to our soils, they're used to our conditions, they can handle not getting water for a long time. And when you plant natives, you generally have to put in fewer resources. They don't need as much fertilizer and maintenance. They do still need some maintenance. And then they also support local pollinators and wildlife. Not necessarily better than introduced ornamentals, but sometimes, because some of our native bees and native pollinators are specialists, and they will only go to a certain species of plant. So sometimes you will support our natives. Was there a question? Did you have a question, ma'am? No. Okay. I thought I saw a hand. Yes.
It's not a question, it's a point. In mining, we reclaim after the mining is done,
mm-hmm.
and using native species is the answer for that. Introduced species don't survive as well as the natives.
Excellent. So he was saying in mining reclamation, after mining goes through, they reclaim the land, and using native species to reclaim that is the answer because the introduced don't last. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's an excellent point. So, again, the benefits are many in using natives. They promote biodiversity. Again, you're working with and for nature, so you're going to use fewer resources. Again, provide pollinator habitat. And if you are interested in supporting pollinators, it's one of those things where if you build it, they will come. They will find whatever you're planting. There was a study done in New York City, I think it was in Harlem, where people wanted to put in a community garden, so vegetables but also flowers. So they ripped up a parking lot, and there was an abandoned parking lot, and they put in a community garden, and the members were concerned, well, are the insects, the bees going to find this and pollinate it so that we, you know, have our food crops? And sure enough, they did. In the first season, they found 50 different species of bees. So in the United States, we have close to 4,000 species of bees, so it's far more than just the honeybee, and they all pollinate. So in, you know, concrete jungle, you couldn't find a bee to save your life, but when they planted this big community garden and had all these flowering plants, they came from somewhere. So that's pretty cool. If you build it, they will definitely come. Okay, talked a lot about natives. I'm realizing I need to pick up the pace a little bit. So natives can be incorporated into an existing landscape. It's not an all or nothing kind of thing. If you already have a big, beautiful yard full of non-natives, you can, as things die out or as you find spaces, you can incorporate natives and they can do just fine together. They're also what we call adapted plants, so they're not native, but we know that they can withstand our natural conditions and they will not be invasive. So that's one of the issues with introducing plants from other places, is that they might find a niche over here where they're like, oh, this is the perfect growing condition, and I'm going to crowd out all the other stuff. That's where we get into trouble. So are y'all familiar with myrtle spurge? Have you heard of that landscaping plant? It was brought in by the horticulture trade. It's really cute and pretty, but it's really problematic. It escapes into our natural areas. It's actually really bad for certain wildlife. It can displace native plants. So now there are all these efforts to what they call purge the spurge, where they go out and do big weeding efforts to get rid of that. And it was, you know, horticulture trade is guilty. We brought it in because we liked how it looked. So you want to make sure that what you're planting is not going to be invasive. Another thing for water conservation is don't overplant. Sometimes gardeners have a hard time with that. You know, you go to the garden center and you see all these things you want to plant and you find places for it. If you have fewer plants, you need less water. So, and then prioritizing what you plant, trees, shrubs, perennials, and really finding that right balance. So this is a yard in Denver, a neighborhood in Denver, and these are all native plants. So big, bright, beautiful, blooming plants. To my eye, this is really beautiful. Lots of green, lots of flowers, all native. And you can see it's just a typical Denver neighborhood. Can see these other homes. This used to look like that. Driveway, turf, tree, maybe a couple shrubs. And this gentleman has really transformed his yard. This is another garden. This picture, it's a little bit hard to see. I believe it's called the Centennial Garden. It's in downtown Denver. The story is, it's near Illich's, if you know where that is. The story is that when Wellington Webb was the mayor of Denver, he and his wife took a trip to France and saw all of those beautiful, you know, Renaissance gardens over there, came back, and his wife decided that she wanted to have a really formal, beautiful garden, but using all Colorado natives. So yeah, that's why it's called the Centennial, we're the Centennial State, so this is the Centennial Garden. So sort of celebrating what Colorado has to offer, but in the format of the very formal garden. So it's a little bit hard to see in this picture, but there's a lot of symmetry and a lot of formality. So you can use natives in all different ways. It doesn't have to look wild and woolly. So now I'm gonna zip through pretty quickly some specific plants. You have the plant lists over there that have many more species. But this is a blanket flower. So this is our native blanket flower. There's another blanket flower that it's sometimes called firewheel, that has more red around here. That's a different species. It's not the native, but it's also a good one. But this is our native. And one thing that's pretty cool is that there's a moth whose entire life cycle, so from pupa to adult, the whole thing takes place on the Gallardia flower. So I don't know if you can see it, but there's a moth right there and a moth right there. They really blend in. So if you're really into supporting wildlife, this plant helps this moth. And this moth is only found in Boulder County, Larimer County, and up into across the Wyoming border a little bit, so it has a really small range. Prairie coneflower is a really pretty one, kind of a wildflower, meadowy looking plant. Sometimes you get it with red and yellow, sometimes it's all yellow. It gets pretty big. Scarlet globe mallow is a fun one. It can be a little bit tough to get established, but it's really very orange. Like, it's rare. It's sort of like an oriental poppy orange, which you don't see a lot. And once it's established, it is tough as nails. You'll be hard-pressed to kill it, unless you overwater it. If you give it too much water, it won't be happy. I used to live in Tucson, Arizona, and these would be just coming up the cracks of sidewalks and just living in really tough conditions. Purple prairie clover is a really lovely one. It has a very delicate growth form and these really lovely purple flowers. This is there's fringed sage here on your left and prairie sage on your right. So if you're just looking for that sort of filler plant that doesn't actually bloom, but this can be in place of something like sea foam or other artemisias. These are native options. Sulfur flower is an excellent one. Butterflies love sulfur flower. It gets covered in the fairly early spring to early summer, covered in these bright, bright yellow flowers. And then in the fall, the foliage turns a really pretty burgundy kind of maroon color. And it's a low-growing kind of mounding plant. This is Desert 4 o'clock. The flowers are shaped like petunias, sort of like in a trumpet. And in the summertime, once these are established, it'll just be covered. You can see that picture on the right. It'll be covered with these flowers. They're really beautiful. And it has a very deep taproot. So again, once it's established, it never needs water. Here's a shrub that is xeric. It's called lead plant. It has really pretty purple spikes. It gets maybe like 3 feet by 3 feet, maybe 4. It has these really pretty purple spikes, and the pollen grains are orange, so you get a really pretty contrast of orange and purple. Pollinators love this one. Here's poppy mallow or wine cup. This is a trailing sort of spreading plant. So every, the crown will be this big, but it'll extend out 3, 4, sometimes even 5 feet if it's really happy. And again, all summer long, it'll just be covered with these really beautiful little flowers. Next we have milkweed. So this is the one that supports the monarch butterflies. If you live near open space or small acreage properties, you need to be a little bit careful with this because it can spread. It's a native, but it can spread, and it's not good for livestock. So you have to be a little bit careful with that. Then we have, this is a pretty common one that you see in the trade, blue flax. Has a really beautiful kind of airy growth habit. Then we have white yarrow. Yarrow comes in a lot of different colors, but the native is white. Okay, so that's our plant section. So now we get to maintenance. So no landscape is maintenance-free, but you need to choose what works for you. So as you're planting your plants and deciding what you want to do, if you want to be out in the garden every day working on it, then you plant accordingly. If you just want to have to do a little bit here and there on the weekends, then you also design and plant accordingly. It's a really good idea to leave perennials up over the winter. It provides some winter interest, and then it also provides shelter and often food sources for birds that overwinter. And these are grasses and some flowers that could have just been mowed down, cut down at the end of the season, and then you would just have a blanket of snow. But I think this gives a lot of winter interest and makes it a little more interesting. So now we've got microclimates. Microclimates are important to think about with xeriscaping. And what a microclimate is the conditions in small areas. So like the east side of your house is going to be much cooler than the west side of your house just because of the angle of the sun and the time of day. So if you really pay attention to that, that'll dictate what kind of plants you plant too. If you layer plants as you're planting, you can see here we've got low story, mid story, and upper story. So all of those plants are sort of working together, and you can, you know, this is shading this, and this is shading that, and providing different little microclimates. Something else for xeriscaping that people are looking more and more at is permeable pavers. So if you have a walking path or a patio or something in your yard, you can have a permeable paver, which is going to allow more water to infiltrate into the ground. So you can see the water comes through and then it makes its way down. And it might not be the actual paver itself, but the seams in between the pavers can allow water to run through. Just a couple of different examples of what that might look like. I just came across this one. I thought that was kind of fun. Somebody made a big chessboard.
Low maintenance.
Yeah, right. Okay, now this is where I'm really going to have to zip, but Mary Beth wanted me to include something about passive rainwater harvesting. So rainwater collection became legal in 2016 to catch rain in barrels. Do you all know about that? You can have a rain barrel. That is called active water harvesting. But there's something called passive rainwater harvesting that is more about how you do your landscaping. So it's basically diverting the water as you receive it over land for immediate use. So you're not holding it for later use. And the idea is you want to slow the water, you want to spread it out, and you want to sink it. You want to get it down into the ground. That's the goal. You don't want it to run off your property and into the storm drains. So the tools that we use are swales, berms, French drains, and rain gardens.
What's a swale?
Well, I'm glad you asked. A swale is basically like a dry creek bed, if you've ever seen that. This is a swale. This is a swale. So it can be a nice landscape feature. You know, we can't see what's over here, but if your downspout is at the top of this, when the water comes rushing off your roof, you can actually move the water to whatever might be over here and get more water right there. So you're moving water horizontally to where you actually want it. Berms are the next one. It's basically just a raised area that's going to slow water down. So you want the angle to be right. If this angle is too sharp, the water will come in and start to undercut that and erode it. But if it's a nice smooth grade, the water will slowly fill there. And it might top over it, but it's going to stop this water, which will then sink into the ground, which, again, that is our goal. A lot of people have heard of French drains as sort of maintenance things, like if you're having issues with your foundation because there's too much water, you use a French drain to move the water away. It can also be used as a landscape feature. So you can see this is a house. The gutter is attached to this. The dotted line means it's below the soil level. So it goes below grade until it reaches a pipe that's perforated. It has holes in it. And then you let the water out where you want the water to come out. So you have it come out over here, and then you have your garden planted around there. So again, you're just sort of manipulating where you have the water go.
Why is it called French?
I don't know. I don't know why it's called a French drain. That's a good question.
It's called a French drain because a guy named French invented it. Doesn't have anything to do with
the country?
France, right.
Okay. So it's called a French drain because the guy who invented it was Mr. French.
Right.
Good. Thank you. That's excellent information. I've never been asked that before. So the final one is rain gardens. So these do everything. They slow the water, spread the water, and sink the water. So they use plants and soil and microbes, and they do all this stuff. It's basically a big basin that is planted to look like a garden. So you can look at a rain garden and not necessarily know that anything is going on there, but it's constructed in such a way that the water is diverted there and goes down. And it keeps the water on site. It cleans the water. So as you can see, here's a French drain from the house, and the water is released here. And again, this is constructed to be able to really hold a lot of water, but up on top, it just looks like a nice garden. You do want to plant them where runoff naturally occurs. You don't want to put it at a high point because then you're having to figure out how to get water up high. And you always want to plan your garden like a river flows. Water follows the path of least resistance, and so you want to work with that. There are some sort of rules that you want to follow with rain gardens. You want them at least 10 feet away from buildings, because again, you're bringing a large volume of water into that spot. You don't want them too close to wells or septic tanks. And so I will end with something called integrated design. And so all of these different things that I've talked about, how you design your garden, the plants you use, the mulch, if you're using swales and rain gardens, that integrating all of these things together is a design strategy that maximizes the potential of your site. So your property, your site can really do a lot of work to help conserve water. With the plant material you're using, you can really help to mitigate increase in temperatures in the urban environment. So it really helps the whole surrounding area. And your design elements, they all sort of work together. So there's passive solar, there's passive cooling. If your shade trees are located in the right spot, you're going to be shading your house, which is going to decrease your AC costs. So again, all of these things can really kind of work together. And another term is called stacking function. So your site is doing all of these different things that contribute to the whole. And with that, I end with a quote that is attributed to Benjamin Franklin. I don't know if he actually said it, but he said, apparently, when the well is dry, we know the worth of water, which couldn't be more true. And water is becoming more and more of a scarce resource. So anything that we can do as individuals to help the larger cause, I think, is really important. And that concludes my talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Will. We all either have or see gardens, so that's very important. I have a question. We have dandelions.
Yes, don't we all?
They seem to be very resistant.
Yeah.
And they don't seem to need a lot of water, although they're in the lawn.
Yep.
Have you got any comment about dandelions?
So dandelions, some people love dandelions because they bloom very early and bees like them. So they're good pollinator plants. But some people hate dandelions because they are a weed and they will fill up your whole yard. So they are a biennial, which means they have their life cycle is 2 years. So the first year they're just going to be that the crown, just the vegetative, the leaves, and then the second year is when they send up their flowers. So you can apply herbicides, you know, you can do like weed and feed and that'll get rid of things. Or depending on how many dandelions you have, you can go through with a shovel and just, you know, just chop off the top part of the vegetation, and then the plant is dead. It's not going to grow anymore. So if you can just stop it from blooming and spreading seeds, then you're not going to keep creating more dandelions. Does that make sense? Do you get what I'm saying?
What we found, and I've done this,
yeah.
If you don't get the whole root out,
yeah.
It seems to come back bifurcated. Yeah. I mean, it comes back stronger.
Yeah, but, yeah, right. It says, oh, thank you, do that again. But again, it only lives for 2 years. So your timing is really key. So if you get it when it's just the vegetative part, it will keep growing. But if it's starting to put out the little tiny, you know, the little buds, right, that's it. It's dead. It's not going to grow anymore. Does that make sense? So, but that's pretty intensive maintenance. You have to go out and look at everyone and get it. So chemicals really is the easiest way to deal with them.
We can't eat them.
You can harvest them and eat them.
We don't put chemicals in our lawn because we have a preschool and so on.
So then you get down there with your shovel.
We try and keep them at a minimal level.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have a question.
Oh, I have another thing to add to it. Yes.
Can we have you come down and look at our yard and tell us what we need to do?
Okay, he's asking if I can come look at your yard and tell you what you need to do.
And can you do it?
Can I do that? So, yes and no. As I said in the beginning, I focus more on commercial properties. So I don't do so much single residence. Unfortunately, I wish I could, but my job description dictates that. So we do have a home horticulture person, but they don't really do site visits. But you can always call the office and you can talk to master gardeners and ask them questions. But we don't really have a service where people come and, oh, that's not true. We have lawn checks for individual homeowners. sometimes they'll look at other landscape, but it's really focused on lawns. Mm-hmm. But if you have weeds in your lawn, then that, you know, that counts. So there's a fee. It costs $75.
Yeah, we've done that.
You have. Okay, so that's the service that we would have there.
Or can you recommend a landscape person that will
know what they're doing?
Know what they're doing. Yeah.
So he's asking if I can recommend a landscape person. No, I can't, because we have to be unbiased. So I can't recommend one individual over the other. My other comment, though, quickly on the dandelion is a healthy turf is going to keep weeds out. So if you can get your turf to a point where it's not really weedy and maintain it that way, you're going to have fewer weeds, fewer dandelions coming in, because weeds come in disturbed areas and where turf is sort of patchy or thin. So, yeah.
I had a question about two. Is there a demonstration garden up on the fairgrounds? Is there escape?
There is, yeah. We do have a demonstration on the fairgrounds.
Okay.
So, yeah, we're at basically Hover and Nelson in Longmont. And we've been growing the demonstration gardens considerably over the last 3 or 4 years. So if you haven't been there in a while, yeah, you should definitely come take a look. And the plants are all labeled, and we have signage, and so you can know what is what.
And then my other question is, does the Extension Service work in collaboration with other agencies, for instance, Northern Waters? I met some of their education people and their director at Soil Revolution Conference.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's possibility that we can have them come and do a total assessment and then work with them. So can we also work with you once they...
Do you mean individually or the church property?
The church property.
Yeah, so I work with Northern Water quite a bit, and they sort of provide a similar service to what we provide, a site visit where you do an assessment and you come and check things out. So yeah, we work with a lot of other agencies. For an irrigation audit, if you are interested in looking at what your irrigation output is, Resource Central, if you've heard of them, they have a program called Slow the Flow. And they will come out free of charge. I think anywhere in the city of Boulder, it's free of charge. And I believe they do individual residences and commercial properties. And they'll do that irrigation audit where they look to see if your heads are wonky or how often you're running your clock and all of that, and help you there. So yeah, there are a lot of other resources out there working on the same stuff. Yes?
You know, there's a lot of talk about using salt components as a weed deterrent.
Yeah.
What's your take on
that? Yeah, so she's asking about using salt for a weed deterrent. Salt, the dose is, that's a tricky one, because salt will kill things, but then you have all that salt in your soil, and so other things won't grow. So pretty much we point to no. A lot of herbicides are just very concentrated salt chemistries. You know, so salt definitely kills, but you have to be so careful. And I would pretty much advise against it, because as I said, if you put a bunch of salt in, then nothing else is going to grow in that area. So, you know, the saying, the poison is in the dose. Like, too much of anything is going to kill something. You know, you can kill things by watering it too much. So you do have to be careful with what you use.
Well, thank you very much, Darren.
Thank you
all.
And I would say this is the end of the four-week series for the Green Team presentations. So thank you all for coming, and I hope it's been informative for everybody.
And if you ever have any other questions, you can feel free to reach out to me. Phone number, email up here.
And there are these handouts which you can get as you leave.
Oh, yeah, that's called Desert Forest.
I wish you'd come to my house.